2009 was definitely sure to be a competitive season for you. And then you did go on that season to win a whole bunch of races. You won London, Monaco, and then going into the World Champs, what was that like? Where was your head at that time?
I was cocky. My head was very big. My head was huge. I was cocky. I was arrogant. I was smelling my own, you know what?
Yep.
I was running extremely fast and nobody could stop me. And going into Berlin, the one thing that John Smith said to me, and I'll never forget this, he said, "These women have been here before." And he was talking about Shelly Ann. He was talking about Karan Stewart. And, you know, what he was saying was, don't think that they're not going to step up in this final because they've been here before. And I threw away everything that I had been doing all year. I threw away my mechanics. I threw away my technique. I threw away my patience. And I went out there and I raced. And that's how I got third. I should not have gotten third. I should have won 2009 World Championships. But I learned an extremely big lesson in front of everyone. And that was, you never underestimate anybody.
And you sure don't. So just touching on that slightly, what was that rivalry like with you and Shelly Ann? Because you guys had some battles over the years when you guys were competing.
You know what? You know, people like to call it a rivalry. Rivalries are usually when you can't stand the next person. So I'm not going to say that me and Shelly Ann had a rivalry. We had a competitive, we were competitive with each other. Right. You know, I didn't hate this woman. And so many times the media likes to pin women of color against each other. And yep. And to make it seem like that there could only be one great woman out there. And we were both great. We were both savages. Me, her, Veronica, Karan. We were all lovely, dark-skinned women
yep.
that lined up with a presence. And the rivalry, I guess you would say, was more so of enjoying each other's competitiveness, mm-hmm. knowing that when I lined up with these women, I had to bring it. I couldn't play. I couldn't let anybody think that I wasn't ready that day. That's what I loved about racing them. I had to bring my A game.
Every single time. You really, really
every
did.
Single time. And that's something that the guys didn't do. And we're gonna talk facts. The guys would run away from each other. They didn't race each other all the time, or they would set races up and say, well, this person can't be in the race. So, you know, or this person can't yep. be in the race. And women, we did not do that. I wanted them all on the line.
Every single one, every single
every
time.
Every single one of them. Just like they wanted me in the race, I wanted them in the race as well. We didn't run from each other. We kept track and field hot for several years.
You did, because there was no, and there was always consistency with you guys as well, because you guys would race each other at the big meets, at the Diamond Leagues, at the Golden Leagues as well prior, you know, there was no running away from each other. So then coming to World Champs, it was always going to be the same people there or thereabouts, maybe one or two new people who'd make the final, but you knew what you were working with going into every single final.
Exactly.
And I guess that was a difference. So 2 weeks later, a few weeks later, after, mm-hmm. you know, the slight disappointment of finishing third at the World Championships, you then mm-hmm. continued to set the entire world alight. So where did the switch come? What happened between Berlin missing out on third and the next couple of weeks going into actually running that, you know, fabulous 10:64 race?
I was pissed off.
In a word.
First off, after the Berlin race, I cried in my coach's arms like a baby.
That's okay. That's all right.
I cried. And then after I stopped crying, I apologized to him. You know, that was a year that also John Smith was showing the world that he was still a great coach. You know, so many athletes had left him. So mm-hmm. many athletes had talked so bad about him. And I grew a love for this man. So I wanted to give him a medal to shut everybody up.
Right.
And when I didn't do that, I was more upset with myself that I let him down. Not that I didn't win, but that I didn't win for him. So I told him going into Thessaloniki, I said, I'm sorry, and I'm going to make it up.
And you sure did.
And I did. And I did. And I was mad as you know what.
Yep.
And when that gun clicked, I showed it. And I didn't even know I ran 10-6. I was just like bopping up and down, knowing that I did what I was finally supposed to do. And when they said 10-6, I was like, oh my gosh, I just ran 10-67. So then I was really on cloud 335. Now, after the race, you know, the one thing that upsets me more than anything with our sport is when guys run fast and break the world record, it's put up on pedestals.
Everywhere.
It's, oh my gosh, yeah. It's everywhere. It's on ESPN. It's on the paper. It's on track and field news. But when I ran 10-6, it was more of a, well, how did she do that? Was she clean when she did that? She's so old and she ran that fast. If I didn't get the respect that I was supposed to get. So going into Shanghai with the talk of, oh, I bet you she can't do it again. When you see me cross the finish line and point at the screen, that was for all those haters.
Every single one of them.
Every single one of them bet 10-6-4. Oh, I did that again. And when I went to Daegu 2 weeks later, I ran 10-8 into a negative like 3.1. I ran 10-8 to a negative like 3.1. And I was like, oh, yeah, I would have dropped the hot one again. Like, I was more upset that I wasn't getting the same love as the males would get every time that they run fast.
And how did that make you feel? Because, you know, track and field is huge in our sport, but it's definitely fair to say, with the Blue Ribbon event being the 100 meters, they are always, as in, the press basically are always focused on the sprints. So it's always the men's 100 meters always. And like you said, these guys don't even line up against each other throughout the season consistently. They literally make the final and then it's like, okay. But whereas you guys were consistent all season, you knew who you were up against. And then even post world champs, you were still racing against these women. I remember the season back then, it was going to September. So you're running 10-6 in September. You remember you started the season in April. 10-9, mm-hmm. Dropped to 10-6 September, and you still didn't get the credit. So what was that like? What did that feel like?
I mean, I got credit for it. Let me not disrespect the press that actually gave me the credit that I deserved, because some press definitely did give me the credit I deserved. But I definitely feel like me being the second fastest woman alive in such a premier event that it was not published the way it should have been. You know, it was not put out there the way it should have been. That's the unfortunate part in the sport. The second unfortunate part in this sport right now is, like you said, we had meets up until September. We had avenues to compete, to get our sharpness, to relax, to run in places that had, you know, small towns that treated you like queens. And they don't have that in the sport anymore.
Yeah, that is true.
And it's unfortunate. To me, it just looks like the sport is declining. It's not climbing. Everybody thought that this Diamond League was going to be
a game changer.
Was going to be a game changer. But all it did was close out a lot of those small meets. So you went from being able to run 20 and 30, 100 meters to now what, you're running 8 to 10 a year?
Yeah.
You know, so for the athlete that's not the Carmelita Jeter, your career is pretty much done after USA's.
It's so shocking when you think back.
You're not getting the opportunity to run those small meets that the big runners aren't going to.
Yeah.
You know, so it's starting to trickle our sport down, because now these athletes have to go and get jobs because they can't afford to be a track athlete anymore.
Literally, there's less and less money in the sport. You know, even going back to those times, 07, 09, even before then, I mean, I've been around for a heck of a long time. And you could do those small meets before you get to the big ones, before you got to the Golden League. Like my first Golden League was, what's the last one? Brussels. And mm-hmm. I was up against mm-hmm. Christina Ron, Pintasevich block. I mean, I'm talking a long, long time ago. This is like 05, 06. Mm-hmm. And I was only running like 11.4 at the time and I got a lane. But, you know, those meets before, it was the meets beforehand, like running the small meets in Belgium, France, Holland, that allowed me to get to run yep. fast.
Tingalo.
Yes. Hang, all of those meets. Yes. World challenges. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's exactly mm-hmm. what it is. But we are slightly going on a tangent right now. So when you did coin the title, the fastest woman alive, and running that fast time, how did your life change in that moment?
It definitely changed with, you know, showing the world that things could actually be done. You know, people felt like with Marion Jones running 10.6 and her being disgraced that nobody else could run 10.6 again. And I was the number one person tested in USADA from 2009 through 2012. And that's facts. People can actually look that number up. yeah. I was the highest tested athlete. And I love that. You know, a lot of people were upset when they got tested, but I loved it. I invited them, please come keep testing me. So, you know, my number will always stand. Nobody can ever come and take it from me.
That is true. That is exactly what it's about, really. Just not just being consistent on the track, but also making people aware that you are being consistently tested. Because, you know, we do have a problem in doping in the sport. But there are athletes out there who are performing, who are running fast times, and who are clean. It's not everyone. You can't tarnish everyone with the same brush. But
right.
That's a conversation for another day.
Yes, that's a conversation for another day.
So let's look at 2011, because 2011, another spectacular thing happened, which was the World Champs, and you became world champion.
Yes, that was a year I was not losing. And that's just facts. Like, I was not losing. I had two bronze medals. I was becoming the bridesmaid at all the weddings, you know. I was the bridesmaid and never the bride. I'll never forget in 2009, the commentator said that, and that stuck with me. It truly stuck with me for 2 years. When people don't know that certain things stick with people, good or bad. And that saying that commentator said stuck with me. And I refused to be another bridesmaid in 2011. I trained like a monster. Even when I would throw up, I would wipe my mouth off and get up and do it again. that's how I was training in 2011. Like, you had to take that from me that year. I was just in my zone. I was in my tunnel. I was so, I needed that for myself. You know, we always need something for ourselves. And I'll be honest with you, if I didn't win in 2011, I probably would have stopped running. That would have been my breaker point. Everybody has a breaker point where you yeah. just feel like you keep going and it's not panning out for you and you just get frustrated. And 2011 would have been my breaker if I didn't win. But I was going into that race and it wasn't cocky. It wasn't arrogance. It was belief.
Belief, and you definitely did. So what was it that helped you manifest such a winning mindset?
A losing mindset.
Having that loss in 09, you mean?
Yeah. Having that loss. Having that loss when I knew I wasn't supposed to get it. That hurt. And you know, like I said, sometimes you have to be completely hurt and drop to your knees before you can acknowledge the things that you need to do different. And that's what happened.
Wow. 2011, you became world champion. And then 2012, you made your first Olympic team. Honestly, at this point, you must have felt like a veteran because you've done a lot in such a short space of time. And everything that you achieved up until that point, you were also, you know, it wasn't something where you were in your early to mid-20s. At this point, you were going into your 30s. So 2012, take us back to that in London.
The thing about 2012 is I wasn't going to even compete.
Really? How come?
I lost my aunt to breast cancer in March. I was completely devastated. I wasn't going to practice. John Smith had to literally come to my house and just sit on the couch with me and watch TV because I was just broken. I couldn't really do Nike events because I just kept crying. I was like in a silent depression. I lost someone that I truly cared about. And I always tell people, you know, Nike and everybody, when you're doing great things, they cut you checks, but nobody tells you how to deal with being broken. Yeah.
Grief and loss is heartbreaking.
Is a whole nother ball game. So I wasn't going to compete. And then I kind of sucked myself out of it and said, what would my aunt think right now of me? How would she feel about me not doing what I needed to do? But a lot of it came from my coach. You know, when people see John Smith, they think legendary coach. They think the man that just makes people fast. But I will forever love John Smith because he loved me so much in that moment. He was very gentle with me because I was so broken. And going into USA's, I pulled it together. I made the team in the one and the two. And then going into 2020 London Games, at that point, I had finally came into the reality that I was at the Olympics and I knew I needed to get those medals for my aunt.
And you really, really did. And what was it specifically, or it can be, you know, a collective of things that actually pulled you out of those dark times?
You know, it was truly just my aunt. It was truly just my aunt. That's what pushed me through 2012. I can't even say it was anything else. It was my aunt. It was wanting to get the medals for her. And I did exactly what I set out to do.
And you definitely did. And I remember being in the stadium on a nice, warm, hot Saturday evening in London, because we didn't have a team at that point, so no one cares. But, you know, the women's 4x1 did set the world alight because you guys broke a world record. So what was that like, especially in a 4x1? You know, it had been one of the longest standing records in track and field. So what was that like, you know, running with Tiana and Allison and Bianca? Because you guys, you know, performed amazingly that day.
You know what? I tell the story about me and Bianca because we didn't actually get along. I didn't really care for Bianca. That's facts. You know, everybody kind of knew that. We were just kind of like there. The USA staff wanted to put someone else on third leg because they felt like that person was better than Bianca. Now, one thing about me is I'm a big girl. And if I know that the objective is to win, I want the best person on the third leg, not the fastest person. Right. People get so caught up in fast people, but Team USA had never broken this record and they had four of the fastest women all the time on the relay. But we needed to get four women that had chemistry. Now, Tiana's leg was set. Nobody was touching Allison's leg, but Bianca, even though she wasn't the fastest, Bianca had that dog in her. She was going to bring you the stick, regardless if she was running 12.5 in the open 100. Mm-hmm. She was going to bring you the stick. And that's why we chose Bianca on that relay, was because she had something that you can't coach. I tell people all the time, you can get a super fast person, but if they ain't got no heart or no confidence in themselves, we won't win nothing. So we was going to get in a lot of trouble if Bianca didn't run well, because I picked to be on that third leg. So I was nervous as I don't know what, making sure that Bianca gave me that stick. Now, people always ask me, what was I thinking when I pointed to the clock? The funny thing was, that was me telling all of those people that Bianca Knight shouldn't have been on third leg, where to go and how to get there.
Thank you for listening to a preview of today's show. To hear the full episode, visit www.thehiddengreatness.com. Chicken.